Yeah, it's truth about markets time on Residence 104.4 about London. Sorry.
Yeah, we're in London, and my big question for today, Max,
Yeah.
it is, where's Kenny Boy?
Oh yeah, where is Kenny Boy? You must be referring to this new film project that we are crowdfunding on startjoin.com, which of course it's in the pre-funding stage right now, building up some interest. It's got George Galloway is going to go to Paraguay and look for Ken Lay, who of course was the godfather of modern financialization, which empowered so many of the bankers in the UK and in the US with derivatives and other weapons of mass financial destruction, as Warren Buffett called them. And this is really a story of how we got to where we are today. And in the meantime, we'll be down there in Paraguay talking to folks and looking for Ken Lay, who some speculate is still alive and living down on this huge ranch that the Bush clan bought at about the time of his mysterious this death of mysterious circumstances.
Yeah, well, you know, of course, that Ken Lay died in July of 2000, was it 5 or 6? But this was, of course, yeah, it's more than just the hunt just for him. It's he's basically everywhere, everywhere w around us, from derivatives fraud to offshore, offshore hiding your fraud offshore to this two-tier justice system, because of course he was, other than Bernie Madoff, he was the last big guy to actually go face any sort of justice. And when justice determined that he was guilty, that's the last time that ever happened. So Bernie Madoff was only ever saw justice because he stole from the rich.
Yeah. Well, that was the Ken Lay era. You also had the WorldCom. Bernie Ebbers was around that time, and a few other top line guys. The guy who ran, I think it was called Tyson, who went to jail. And this was a period of the late 80s, early 90s of extreme financialization. And Enron had these 700 special purpose entity accounts off books where they dumped all the risk of all their trades, and they kept the profits on their income statement. And every single quarter they would report great earnings and the stock price skyrocketed. And then one analyst said, "Hey, wait a minute, this is a scam." That analyst very famously was excoriated on a conference call by Jeff Skilling, the CEO, who basically got the guy fired for questioning the genius of the smartest guys in the room at Enron. And of course, there was that book, I'm sorry, the film called The Smartest Guys in the Room, which is a good, really good documentary about Enron's situation. And I'll probably take another look at that film as we head into pre-production on the new film project, Where's Kenny Boy? You know, I would say that the film is in pre-production. So this is why it's appropriate, in my view, of having it listed as a concept on startjoin.com to get, pre-production ducks lined up, get really to just figure out what the budget's really going to be, what the practicality of it really is. Are people really going to be available? And then, really have a real strong project. And then when you open it up to funding, it's all systems are go. That's kind of the concept of a concept, instead of kind of going out there with something that is not completely pre-planned, if you will. Did you get my meaning on that?
Yeah, I think I do. I think I do. I like to jump into the financing and get ready because I see, really what Ken Lay did and what Enron got found guilty of is really quite small change compared to LIBOR manipulation, to Forex manipulation. Now the $5.3 trillion a day market, because what they did was small fry in terms of it was a very targeted frauds. Here with this, the entire system, the fabric of our financial system and LIBOR, Forex is the fix. Gold Fix, the fabric, the way we perceive everything, the way every single consumer, citizen, and, you know, resident of these countries in the Anglo-Saxon sort of banking world, neoliberal economies, this is how we, you know, they're actually tampering with your brain, the way you perceive the world around you.
Well, you know, the Enron situation, what happens is regulators come back with a kind of a half-baked regulations. It was wasn't Graham-Dodd, but there was one before that. Sarbanes-Oxley, I believe, was introduced in the wake of the Enron scandal. So it doesn't do enough. It doesn't really penalize anyone, and the bad guys are not put in jail. They're still operating. So what happens is the guys who created the Enron scandal, they have huge ambitions to make huge frauds. So they move from Enron, they go into bigger pools of capital like Forex, like the LIBOR scandal, because that's the only markets that are big enough for them to realize their outsized ambitions of making $100 billion bonuses, $150 billion bonuses that were paid out on Wall Street. So this is part of the unintended consequences, or maybe not so unintended, when you don't really penalize people who are breaking the law. They are given the green light to continue doing this law breaking, except on a much bigger scale, because their ambitions are quite higher. And you've said basically it's okay. You know, another example of this is that the regulators are coming out with statements this past week saying, you know, maybe high frequency trading should be looked at a little bit more closely, because it appears to just be a case of computer aided theft. And of course, we've been saying this on this show from the very, very, very first week that high frequency trading was ever mentioned in any press anywhere in the world. We told you it's nothing but computer aided theft. It's like siphoning gas from your neighbor's gasoline, essentially, is what we said 5 years ago. And which is what they do. They stick a computer next to the stock exchange and it siphons capital from the exchange. It adds nothing. It's purely criminal behavior. So now, 5 or 6 years later, the regulators are saying, well, maybe this is something to look at. Meanwhile, one of the biggest firms in this industry is going to go public. They're going to do an initial public offering. At the same time, regulators are going to say they're going to outlaw it. So they're going to cash in one huge, big cash out. They'll make a $1 billion flotation. That stock will end up in pension accounts, where it'll quickly nosedive down to zero in value. And the folks that have made hundreds of billions of dollars in that scandal, of those criminal activities, will be already focused on the next scam. Regulators will say, you see, we went after high frequency trading, where the horse was had bolted out of the barn years ago. They're years behind. And of course, it brings up this question: the regulators, they're understaffed, underpaid, they're not well organized, they're corrupt. And so the cycle just competes. There's more scandals, more theft going on. It's just, we don't know exactly what form it'll take next. And but one thing's for certain, if there's no deterrence or penalties for breaking the law, then there's no reason why we won't see another huge wave of scandals, financial scandals.
So referring back to 5 years ago, we covered that on our press TV show. I forget the name of it. On the Edge with Max Kaiser. You interviewed Tyler Durden from Zero Hedge on the phone. And they had done the early work on high-frequency trading. That was in 2009. And Tyler said at the time that $100 million per day was being scooped out of the markets. Now, the beauty of the size of the markets is that you're only stealing a buck or two, or maybe even like 10 cents, 20 cents from every client or every fund out there, every account out there. So, you know, Joe Bag of Donuts out in Idaho says, well, they only stole 10 cents today. You know, I'd rather get angry about the immigrant down the street, or, you know, some poor guy who might make $5 more per year than I do, and I think that's unfair that he makes $5 more, that sort of thing. They focus their energy on that. Now, the Sarbanes-Oxley thing, I want to say that, you know, I think we should interview for our film Francine McKenna, because she, of course, used to work at PricewaterhouseCoopers and does all of this sort of accounting forensic work. And she will say that, you know, despite Sarbanes-Oxley being brought in post Ken Lay, what it did is increase the barrier to entry for a lot of people. So normal businesses, small businesses earning like $1 million a year, they have the, you know, the compliance costs of Sarbanes-Oxley are high. But for somebody like JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs or MF Global, which, you know, John Corzine clearly should have been prosecuted under Sarbanes-Oxley, because the CEO is supposed to be personally responsible for anything he signs off on. If he signs those accounts and says that money is there, it should be there. Well, he signed off on those accounts and he's now claiming that he didn't know what he was signing. It was all confusion, chaos, blah, blah, blah. He got away with it. But Sarbanes-Oxley was put in there for exactly that reason, because Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling said they didn't know that it was all fraud.
Right. And it doesn't go far enough to deter criminal behavior. Now, Jeff Skilling was put into jail for something like 25 years. He, of course, once he's in jail, was able to leverage all the money he made and contacts, and he just had 10 years knocked off his jail sentence. So Jeff Skilling will be out free on the street in another 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so, again, there's no deterrent for massive these crimes. Meanwhile, people are caught with, you know, half a joint, et cetera, put away for 20 years, 30 years. Or, you know, Aaron Swartz exercising his constitutional right to fair use, threatened with 35 years and maximum detention, ends up killing himself. So this is a part and parcel of what you have, this growing unrest. Now, around the world, people are, of course, staging revolutions. And you saw that with the Arab Spring and other places. But now, you know, you also have another huge trend, which is the people are abandoning the U.S. dollar as world reserve currency. And I think this is what we're seeing now in the Russia, Crimea, China's Russia, Germany situation, is that, you know, Russia realizes that there's a way out of the U.S. dollar. And this is what the people running America don't seem to understand, is that the other countries have a choice. They don't have to be in the U.S. dollar prison.
Well, I think the U.S. will be forcing them off it, because it's financial war. Now, a lot of innovation, by the way, always happens during wars. I mean, look at Cuba, for example, the longest embargo in the history of the world. You know, it's been 50 years embargo against Cuba. And what have they had to do? Well, they've had to innovate, and they have one of the best medical systems in the world, and they have all sorts of patent applications on cancer cures and drugs, because they've had to create their own, because they're not allowed to be sent the parts. Mm-hmm. And the ingredients from pharmaceutical companies aren't allowed to do deals with them. So they've had to create their own. Now, with the U.S. and these sanctions, I think that, you know, Visa and MasterCard, and I don't even know if it's just a WikiLeaks sort of situation where they're not ordered to stop doing business with them, but Visa and MasterCard just stopped doing business with these Russian banks. So on the one hand, that is a short-term success on the battlefield, but in terms of the war, I think it's dangerous, because it encourages people to come up with alternatives, because if you're going to be cut off, I mean, China has to look at that and say, well, one day when we're next, you know, do we want to be cut off from the Visa MasterCard grid, and should we come up with our own alternative system?
Yeah, well, this is the problem when you have two companies dominating international payments like Visa and MasterCard. They create a duopoly, and they're very tied in with the government and the banking system. So they can just arbitrarily, autonomously decide that one country is no longer on their system. And we know that from last week's revelations that all of the tech companies were completely in the loop on the NSA scandals. Yeah, I've maintained that there's always been a quid pro quo there with the in the form of a click fraud arrangement. I think that's becoming clearer now with every week with new reveals. But yeah, Visa, MasterCard, we saw it with Iran. I think they actually had to get more of a formal permission to cut Iran off. And then now with Russia, they just rubber stamp it. It's not even anything that they have to have a discussion about. They just decide, well, we're just going to create this embargo. We're going to cancel you out. There's SWIFT, which is the international money transfer system. I'm sure they're going to try to use SWIFT like they did in Iran, or they have doing in Iran, to try to isolate Russia. So you have this financial war going on. U.S. was hoping that China would kind of not jump into Russia's camp. That's false. China's in Russia's camp. So is India. Because, of course, Russia is a big seller of military hardware to India, and so is Germany. I think this is the big surprise, because Germany is it's not stupid enough to side with the dollar, since Germany knows, with their experience of not getting their gold back, that U.S. doesn't have their gold, the dollar is doomed, so they're not gonna tie their cart to a sinking ship. So you've got Germany, China, Russia, India on the Euro-Asia axis versus the U.S., U.K., and Israel that are all basically tied to the dollar and central banks that are printing to create so-called growth and don't seem to realize that they are causing deflation and depression by all that printing. They seem either they're just completely ideologically blinded, or they are the level of corruption is unbelievable.
Well, part of this financial war as well is the remarkable story of in the oil broker in Switzerland. Gunvor. So that they just basically cut Gunvor, which is one of the biggest oil brokers in the world in Switzerland, they cut them off because they reckon Putin was a part owner via his friend who was a part owner. So who is the friend? Gunvor is the world's largest it's one of the world's largest commodity traders, and they've been cut off the grid and they face sanctions. But it emerged oil rose on today on simmering tensions in Ukraine, but gains were tempered by stronger dollar. The Federal Reserve hinted at an interest rate rise early next year. The oil market is being driven higher by increased fears of disruption in crude supplies following the expansion of U.S. sanctions against Russia. Traders are closely monitoring events in Eastern Europe after Russia absorbed the Crimea. And this Gunvor is the world's largest commodity traders, and they were targeting, in particular, Russian billionaire Gennady Timchenko, a co-founder of Gunvor, a leading independent commodity trading company involved in the oil and energy markets. Now, it emerged that the owner of Gunvor said, actually, Timchenko sold his shares last year. So he doesn't actually own the company. And apparently the U.S. didn't know this, or nobody even knew this. But here, remember, part of the U.S. Constitution is that you're not supposed to be guilty by association with anybody. Mm-hmm. But we've seen that removed across the world, is that if you happen to even walk past this guy Timchenko in the train station in Zurich, they may just, because everything is followed and GPS and RFID and they track you, they know your phone. If you walked past them, they could say, well, you might be associated with him because you were within 2 feet of him.
Mm-hmm. Well, you remember that the game was 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
Which is, you can figure out that everybody is within 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon because he was in this film and so-and-so was in that film and so-and-so was in the third film and so-and-so watched that film while being in a certain place, which is related to something else, and that's where I was at the time. So the fact is that, like, I don't know what theory this falls under or what physical phenomenon this pertains to, but Everyone is connected to everybody, probably within 6 degrees of separation or less. And so the surveillance state that is the global world, connected through global databases, means that you could take, I'm sure everyone is 6 degrees separated from Osama bin Laden. You know, I'm sure the entire global population, if you looked at this big data and program the search in such a way, you could claim that anyone, even a newborn infant just out of the womb, would be within 6 degrees of Osama bin Laden, and therefore they're guilty. So that's one of the risks of big data, is that it gives the potential for an authoritarian surveillance state like you have in the UK, in the US, and in Israel, to simply say, well, you're a terrorist, and here's the connection because of your what you were just saying. You were in the same room at the time. The facial recognition was recognized you, and you were getting on a train, and that train was going to a town where some guys were building a bomb the day before, and then this is the problem with having authoritarian surveillance state, is that everyone is guilty, no matter, and you just have to come up with the algorithm and say, you know, okay, write an algorithm that proves that Joe Bag of Donuts is guilty, and the computer will spit that out. It's very simple. They just go through the database and they look through all this surveillance data and they spit it out. So, you know, this is unfortunately the situation where you're using now. Well, let's see what's going to happen. I mean, they're saying that they're trying to impose economic sanctions like they did in Iran. You know, Jim Rickards, who was following the economic sanctions on Iran, he's not, if you read his tweets, he's not all that sanguine on the prospects of there being much success. I think he thinks that the Iranian economic sanctions effort was a kind of a bust. Didn't really work out because, of course, it forced Iran into the arms of Russia and China, and so they started doing bilateral currency swaps.
Well, plus they export oil, which is fungible, and in exchange for gold, which is fungible. You can't stop. He thought that was a mistake because it would force them to start using gold, and you don't want oil to start being priced. You don't want a gold price for oil out there and on a market somewhere. So he thought that was a danger to the dollar to do that.
Yeah. So that's what's happening. So this is just going to force, you know, there's already talk about it, China, Russia getting together, and there's something on Zero Hedge. They're going to create a petro commodity gold-based currency unit of exchange. So then dollar gets diminished. The dollar's losing its traction around the world as world reserve currency. And the huge benefits that come with that for Americans will evaporate. What that means is that food and energy costs for the average American, which compared to the rest of the world, these costs are enormously cheap because of the seniorage that comes with having the world reserve currency. So once you remove it, then suddenly the U.S., like people around the world, will be paying, you know, $15 to $20 a gallon for gas. Food costs will double or triple. And then suddenly wages, of course, will not be going up. They'll continue to go down. So you'll have lots and lots and lots and lots of poor people suddenly.
Well, by the way, I might want to, you know, you can't really understand what's going on in the world right now without understanding the energy politics, and one of the biggest crucial stories about the Russian Crimea Ukraine story is natural gas. And we have a crowdfunded, the world's first crowdfunded financial news program called Get Real. We financed it on startjoin.com. And we have an episode out right now. If you go to YouTube, you must watch it. It's called Get Real with Jan Skoyles, Skoyles. And it's episode 3. And we talk about natural gas. And Jan had interviewed Henning Goylstein, who is with Reuters. and they really break down all of the facts about natural gas. And you know, the US, basically the US is saying, and all the McCain-like cold warriors are saying, well, we can beat Russia because the US has all this fracking, right? And for two things, they say Europe can frack, which of course it can't, because first of all, it's much more densely populated than the US. And an interesting point he raises about Europe and England and in the UK is that in America, if you find fracking reserves, natural gas reserves, shale oil, shale gas reserves on your land, you stand to benefit. Here, the government stands to benefit, the crown does. So if you have the misfortune of owning a home under which shale gas reserves lie, the crown gets all the benefit. You don't get it. So here they plop down a giant rig, and as Henning Gloystein points out, they only last a few months, maybe up to 2 years. That's it. And then you've got a lot of lorries, tankers filled with water having to come in every day. So in the UK, if you find shale gas reserves on your land, you're basically doomed. In America, you know, there's incentive for the people because they get to collect some of the revenue. The other thing is that the US has a lot of natural gas because of all of this fracking that's going on in the United States, but it's a closed market. So there's a glut of it, which has driven down the price of you know, natural gas supplies to Americans. And one thing he points out is if they ever even build these LNG terminals to export it, first of all, it's against the law in the United States to export energy reserves. So they'd have to change the law to make sure that they can export it. And then once they do that, then they have to build these LNG terminals, which are billions of dollars, a huge safety concern. There's so you have to have a lot of security around these facilities. A lot of security around the ships that would send the reserves out. But the problem is, Europe pays twice as much as America right now for their natural gas. And even more than that, Asia pays twice as much than Europeans. So if Americans were suddenly their gas supplies, natural gas supplies, were on trading on an international market, obviously, the Asian price is going to come down, but the American price is going to double.
Yeah, you mentioned that whole thing about finding oil in America. You get to keep the profits. You know, and it's the basis of that TV show, The Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh, yeah.
If you remember, it goes the song goes, let me tell you a story about a man named Jed, a poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, when up through the ground came a bubbling crude. Oil, that is. Black gold, Texas tea. Well, the first thing you know, old Jed's a millionaire. Said California's the place you ought to be, so they loaded up the truck and they moved to Beverly Hills, that is. Movie stars, swimming pools. So here's the story of Jed. He struck oil shooting for some food, and he made millions and millions of dollars. But in the UK, it wouldn't be like that. It'd be like, let me tell you a story about a poor guy from Shropshire. He was shooting at some food, and up through the ground came a bubbling methane. The government came, threw him off his land. He's living down in the gutter now, doing tricks for a cup of pounding sand.
Actually, it would be Prince Charles came and kicked them out because
Yeah.
it's the crown. Remember, British people aren't citizens; they're subjects. So that's an important thing to remember: they're subjects. Lord knows what Europeans are; probably even worse. But also, in most of Europe is the same thing. The government would take the profits and own basically the mineral rights. So that's why he thinks it's going to be a tougher thing. Plus, in the UK, look at the resistance to windmills. He said these people don't seem to understand what these fracking rigs look like. They're a lot less pleasant to look at than windmills, and require a lot of traffic from huge lorries delivering water nonstop every single day. So you'll have a lot of heavy traffic right going past you in order to service that ugly rig near you. Whereas, of course, you don't need to do the same sort of delivery and traffic for a windmill.
Yeah, and to pay for it, of course, the government prints money, which, of course, jacks up the price of energy, which then incentivizes people to do fracking so that requires more water and requires more money printing. I mean, it's all just a vicious loop that's completely unnecessary. But it's a disease, basically. You know, it's a disease. It's a fracking cancer. It's an economic cancer that feeds on itself. There's no economic benefit to other than the cancerous types behind it. But if you're on the consumer side, you just prices are going to go up, you know, and you deal with the ecological disaster of the fracking. And your gas prices, as even I think Mark Carney recently said, this is not going to make the price of energy lower.
Yeah, George
Osborne. So you're not going to get lower energy prices because all the money printed to make this happen is going to debase the pound. So your price of energy is actually going to go up.
Plus, your house value will also go down. Well, who knows? People don't seem to care about anything here, but it rising. So even the things on the floodplains, 5 feet underwater, and they'll be like selling it for gazumped by ghost gazumpers. So the other thing he mentioned was that China actually has probably the largest shale gas reserves, but because it requires so much water, they actually have a huge water shortage problem in China. So whether or not they could even get at it, even with 0% interest rates, it's the physical limits of a lot of peak, everything is hitting. So you have the problem of peak water there, and it combined with never-ending drought and then never-ending floods, is they're having whether or not they'll ever be able to exploit those said.
Oh yeah, well the ecological ceiling is being hit, whether it's peak resources, peak credit. So these are all kicking in, and but it doesn't stop the governments from printing scads of more money printing. Which is just exacerbating the situation. It's making it worse.
Well, speaking of peak everything, this is an amazing story that has emerged this past week in the UK. This is just unbelievable. Student fees policy likely to cost more than the system it replaced. The proportion of graduates failing to pay back student loans is increasing at such a rate that the Treasury is approaching the point at which it will get zero financial reward from the government's policy of tripling tuition fees to £9,000 a year. New official forecasts suggest the write-off costs have already reached 45% of the £10 billion in student loans made each year, and it's about to hit 48.6%, which is the mark where they no longer make money. They actually lose money. So by tripling the fees from three, they should have kept it at three. They would have made more with £3,000 annual fees than £9,000, because the government, the taxpayer, has to pay for those costs when these students can't pay back these loans. Because part of the reason is they didn't forecast how much incomes would be dropping. So you don't have to start paying back your loans until you make £21,000 a year. But too many people aren't actually earning £21,000 a year. So they're not having to pay back their loans.
You're right. Well, this is all very predictable. As we said when they introduced the... So remember when it was called the top-up fee? Mm. It's just like, oh, just a few, Bob, to top up. Make sure you can buy books and pencils. You know, then it went, you know, predictably, of course, once they stick their hand in your pocket, went up to £9,000, and then the laws of diminishing returns kick in. The job market is deteriorating because the only jobs available are from bankers making bogus loans to students, and that's saturated. There's a glut of bankers. That's why so many are killing themselves. There's a banker glut. So there's only jobs are available are pushing bad debts around. So there's no money to be made to pay back the loan. And, of course, the way it's structured is silly. It's all capped the way it is. And So it's the law of diminishing returns. It's turning in. What happens is this: it ends up driving up the national debt because all of those debts will be repackaged, sold off, and back and forth, and amongst the government agencies until it just basically is added to the, I believe it's 1.8 trillion pounds in debt the UK now has. Remember when we first started talking about this, the UK had 1.1 trillion pounds of debt. Now the UK, not the deficit, mind you, but the debt, they've got 1.8 trillion pounds of debt. So this is a failed policy. It's predictably failed, would fail because it's not written by economists or even market savvy people, or it's just written by debt pushers. And so now that debt's going to go up. The fracking industry will also, after 2 or 3 months, it no longer yields any energy. There'll be a huge cleanup cost, and the price of energy will go up, which will impoverish a lot of people. And guess what? The national debt will go higher. So the national debt in the UK will be over 2 trillion pounds soon enough. And the only way that that's able to sustain itself is by having these interest rates near 0%. Mark Carney at the Bank of England saying, "Yeah, we're going to keep interest rates low," but in the background are raging currency wars. So wars are no longer tanks and bombs and armies. It's currency wars. People are buying and selling on the Forex market, LIBOR market, stock market, options market to try to move prices up and down. At some point, they'll come for the dollar, the way they came for, Greece, and they came for Ukraine. They'll come for the dollar. The dollar's day of reckoning will come. Interest rates will then quadruple, and then the whole house of cards blows up.
So let's go back to the student loan thing. So why are they doing this if they're actually losing money? Why does America have their healthcare system, which costs twice as much to the government as any system in Europe, where everybody is covered and treated without question? Why does America charge so much more, and yet also the government, because of the failure to cover 50 million people, why does the government have to pay even twice as much more? Why doesn't the government say, well, we could reduce our cost by half if we adopt a more French system, for example? Well, they don't. But one thing you must note with all these students who now have these huge debts, they're graduating with 50,000, £54,000 in debt. So what it does do, however, is keep them 30 years of slave, because for 30 years they cannot escape those debts, and it is hanging over them should they ever strive to achieve more, and should they actually, do more later in life. So they always will have this around their necks. It's not written off for 30 years. So only once they're like 54, 55, 56 will it be taken away from them. The same thing in America. So you have those huge debts. The government has to pay them. Say you don't have any money. Say you're only earning $20,000 a year, so about £15,000, £14,000 a year in America. You have to go to the emergency room because you're having a heart attack. They have to treat you. They have to save you. So you don't have the money to pay them. So the government pays it, but that debt you can never write off. So it's there as a threat anytime, like they garnish any of your pay. So say you get a raise to $25,000, they'll just garnish the pay. They'll just take it from you.
Yeah, indentured servitude is the goal, because why not just keep everybody on the debt farm? And it's a great business. And the prison business is a big business. Debt farm's a big business. And the reason people tolerate it is that there's a background noise of house price speculation, so that you've got lots of people are speculating on house price movements, and a lot of people are cashing in on house price movements. But that's in a bubble. So the bubble is, remember in 1990 here in London, prices collapsed by 40%. A collapse of 40% or more is not outside the realm of possibility, and at this juncture in the cycle, I would say we're getting close to that level.
However, back in the 1990s, when I was here during that time, it was a mostly British population here and mostly British buyers. Now it's Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait. Kuwait just bought the building that we make our studio, our show in. You have Russian oligarch money, you have Chinese oligarch money. So you didn't have any of those sort of programs that they now have to, up to 60-70% of properties over £1 million are sold to foreigners. So some of these, all the new builds, some of them are sold 90% to foreigners. So it's not, you don't need these, you know, pasty British peasants to for the monarchy, the crown to survive.
Yeah, that's it's a different type of buyer, speculator, and it is driven from overseas buyers, and so it's been going on for a while. And of course, in China, there's actually, they print more money than anyone else in the world, and to try to save, hold on to some of that money, they come here and they buy these properties. And their attitude is, look, if it crashes 50%, that's still 50% of something versus 100% of nothing that I would have ended up with had I kept my my money in China. So that they're willing to take a 50-60% hit on their real estate property. Are the British people that are investing alongside the Chinese people, are they willing to take a 50-60% hit? Because when the 50-60% hit comes, the Chinese people are going to be smiling. They'll be quite happy because they managed to hold on to 40-50% of the money they stole. You, the British person, who probably is leveraged quite extensively to get in on this action, are now negative equity and you're losing your home. The Chinese are happy, you're unhappy. Now, how is Boris Johnson going to sort that out? He's going to have a bunch of happy Chinese people and unhappy British people.
No, he's just approved the purchase of 2 water cannons for London. So, I mean, remember, that's who you're competing against. Here are guys, you're competing against bank robbers, essentially. So guys go into a bank, hold it up, Kalashnikovs, AK-47s, smoke grenades, sound grenades. They go in there, take all this money. They take $10 million, say. Then they go down to the guy who launders it for them, who washes the money for them. That guy gives them, you know, 30 cents on the dollar, maybe, in order to clean their hands of it, in order to wash their hands of it.
Right.
So these guys are, you know, in China, in the case of China, they're looting the country and they're trying to get it out before the people come for it. These are party members connected to the party. The party is now cracking down because there's so many protests and outrage at the lifestyle of these multi-billionaire connected people. And they're stealing it from their country. They're taking it out of the country before the people can rise up and take it. So what are they doing? They're putting it here. And if they get 50 cents back, that's a lot better than the local laundromat.
Right. So those are the underlying dynamics that are driving this property market higher. And when it gets to these high levels, everyone starts to justify the high levels by claiming that there's a shortage of housing and they never build any more land and land is always blah, 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 you know, all these self-feeding arguments kick in. And, you know, definitely at that part of the cycle. But what's happening in China itself, apparently, prices in Hong Kong, where a lot of people have been speculating, are, what's the word I'm looking for? Crashing, yeah. Prices in Hong Kong are down sharply. So there's a game, a parlor game, if you will, of when is the global real estate market going to pop? You have the incredible overvaluations in Vancouver, in London, in other cities around the world. And it's a global phenomenon. And it's been going on now since the, you know, the bottom, during and bottom of the 2008 crash. So you have now this game of when is this going to pop? So according to Zero Hedge, it popped last week. Okay, are they going to be right? Maybe they will be. I think, you know, people have been calling the top in this market now. Every single month, somebody has said this is definitely the top. Someone has said this, and so far, nobody's been correct. But according to somebody on Zero Hedge, in fact, last week was the top.
Yeah, I think that's, well, the BMO in Boston, that giant asset managers, their top guy said, I forget who used to be their top guy, but this new top guy, he said the markets are 50-70% overvalued by any valuation. So they're basically 50% in equities, 50% cash at this point, because you've got to be in the market when the Fed's pumping it. But they said it's very overvalued, and they're just the 50% of their assets that they do have in the markets is just relative. You have to say some are better buys. They've got the Johnson & Johnson, those classic defensive shares. But I want to look at this article here on Reuters, because you were talking about Hong Kong. There's been a massive liquidity crunch there driven by the government. Of course, they're not bailing out all these oligarchs running these funds. And they've leveraged up against various commodities, so copper and steel and various metals. They've used that as leverage. Mm-hmm. And so basically they're all going bust, and there's been huge collapses in the past week or two. And the government's not bailing them out. They all expect it to be bailed out, but the government won't. So as credit tightens at home, Chinese sell Hong Kong luxury real estate. Cash-strapped Chinese are scrambling to sell their luxury homes in Hong Kong, and some are knocking up to 20% off the price for a quick sale as liquidity crunch looms on the mainland. Wealthy Chinese were blamed for pushing up property prices in the former British territory, where they accounted for 43% of new luxury home sales. It just shows you the quantity of money that has been stolen from the mainland China. So they bought 43% of Hong Kong. They were buying up to 75% of luxury London properties. They were buying, I don't know how much, of Vancouver luxury properties. They were buying all of that. They're spending a lot in New York City as well. Mm-hmm. So there's just a sheer billions that has been spent. So they accounted for 43% of new luxury home sales in the third quarter of 2012 before a tax hike on foreign buyers was announced. A rush to sell coincides with a forecasted 10% drop in property prices this year as a tax increase and rising borrowing costs cool demand. At the same time, credit conditions in China have tightened. Earlier this week, the looming bankruptcy of a Chinese property developer owning 3.5 billion yuan or $565 million heightened concerns that financial risk was spreading. Some of the mainland sellers have liquidity issues, say their companies in China have some difficulty, so they sold the houses to raise cash.
Right, so that tends to indicate that there's something going on there, and they're the tip of the spear of the global spec market. So if that starts to unwind, it has a knock-on effect. The Chinese yuan is falling in value, which, remember, people were all concerned about it, it being currency manipulation and all kinds of things that they were concerned about. Well, now you've got a huge fall in the Chinese currency, which I believe would stoke more trade imbalances around the world. And people were quite concerned about these trade imbalances a couple of years ago. And it looks like there are going to be more trade imbalances. Remember, they were saying that China was thwarting the rise in yuan to keep their mercantilist policy of export-driven GDP growth. And now it looks like the yuan, the RMB, is falling on its own accord. It's not a currency manipulation anymore. It's just outright, deflation and real estate unwinding of this enormously over-leveraged Ponzi scheme. You know, it's funny that 5 years ago and 10 years ago, we were reporting on the Chinese ghost cities. The Chinese build up these enormous, like, 10,000-unit cities, apartment houses of cities and mixed-use retail and commercial and municipal developments, and nobody lives there because the idea is that, the economy is growing so rapidly and that they're going to move into these places and China is growing. But I guess it sounds like that these ghost cities that people have been talking about, if this is true and the Chinese real estate bubble has popped, does that mean that these ghost cities that were built on spec, the way you might write a spec script for Hollywood, they built a 10,000, 20,000 unit city on spec, are just going to dissolve back into the dust from where they came from?
Well, it appears that this is the way the Chinese save as well. So one of the arguments about those ghost cities is that people actually own it as like a savings account, as a pension fund, and they just park their money there because they're look at Chelsea or parts of Kensington, places where all foreign buyers are buying up the things. They're also ghost towns now. Nobody's there because it's just an investment vehicle. They don't even have anybody renting it out. They're just parking their cash there. Now, they also mentioned in this article about Hong Kong, they call it a section called Ghost Town. In a Hong Kong housing development called Valets, about 10 minutes drive from the Chinese border, real estate agents said that between a quarter and a half of the 330 houses are now on sale. At the development's frenzied debut in 2010, 30% of the $30 to $66 million Hong Kong dollars units were sold on the first day, with nearly half going to mainland China buyers. Dubbed a ghost town by local media, the development built by the city's largest developer is one of the many estates in Hong Kong where estate agents are seeing an increase in number of Chinese eager to sell. So they call it a ghost town because none of the mainland Chinese guys actually live there, but they bought these at a minimum of 30 million Hong Kong dollars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it sounds like it's going to be a very interesting landscape of these cities that were built that nobody ever lived in. You know, that could be 20 years from now, you'll find one of these cities like an abandoned relic of the Machu Picchu or Egyptians or something. It's going to be a relic of the 20th century, 21st century of massive developments that, I mean, if aliens came from outer space and they landed on one of these ghost cities in the year 2150, when because of ecological devastation, the Chinese population has become extinct. And they find one of these cities and they'll say, you know, no one ever lived here. There's no evidence that anyone ever lived here. So who built them? They'll wonder. If these sprung up spontaneously, it'll be a mystery for the ages, for a parallel galaxy.
But two things here. First of all, 30 million Hong Kong is about 3.9 million US dollars. And secondly, this is the problem. Now, look around you. You want your neighbors to not be able, if you need to sell, to be able to say, okay, we'll give you 30% off. These Hong Kong guys, these Chinese guys, are willing to slash. The estate agents in this article are saying, they're just preemptively saying, here, 20% below what the market value is. Mm-hmm. They just need cash, whatever. Mm-hmm. So what happens in, you know, all along the Thames, all these properties, if they're just like saying, we'll take 40% off, I don't care. You know, they don't care. They just need any, even £1 million for a 10 million pound property. They'll just take it.
Well, you question of panic selling, which you find in markets. You saw it in 1987, famously, in the New York Stock Exchange. You saw it in the dot-com bubble burst of the year 2000. You know, the NASDAQ dropped 90%. That was an equal or greater drop than even the 1929 crash on Wall Street. So these crashes are self-feeding. You have panic selling. And of course, the panic selling begets more panic selling. So yeah, the question is, you've got all these high-end luxury flats in London that are built for this global caravan of hot money generated by free money printing thanks to central banks. When the music stops, and they're forced out of these properties and they're panic selling their properties. Okay, so who's going to buy a 20,000 square foot luxury marble topped kitchen, jacuzzi, you know, rooftop terrace, you know, 5 million pound studio overlooking the Thames? Okay, who's the buyer of that? Is it going to be Mr. and Mrs. Council Estate who are moving up from Shortage, you know, or from Brixton, or from Bermondsey. They're going to move from Bermondsey to this. They're paying 800 pounds a month. They're going to go, and they're going to what? They're going to move to this flat and pay 7,000 pounds a month. Who's going to buy? Who's going to live there? So there's no market. The market is completely distorted. So you have this Oz-like city of diamond-clad speculators who've been gifted trillions of free dollars for their good fortune of having been taking the right graft from the right corrupt banker, suddenly disappear. How does that? What happens then? Can you speculate on that?
Well, we only have a few moments left, but I think this Hong Kong is quite a good leading indicator, the canary in the coal mine, I guess you could say, of how fast these guys will pull out their money, and at whatever loss they don't care. Like we said, that there's a two sides to that equation where they don't care if house prices fell on their own 50%, but if they're the ones that cause the, you know, they just rip it out and, you know, everything around you collapses in price. Sure, you might have some more properties for a good price for some more Europeans to move in, but you know, the disorder of these sort of the hot money, you've seen it in Iceland, you saw it in Thailand, you saw it, you know, hot money is can be very pleasant on the way up, but it's equally unpleasant on the way down.
Right, you've got the rat through the snake effect. So, you know, as it moves through the snake, you know, it creates this bulge, this moving bulge that, but it moves through it, you know, moves beyond it. The people who are experiencing the bulge, like here in London, there's an interesting point in the cycle where they become delusionary, where they believe that it's their godlike tendencies that have caused this good fortune to befall them, and that it can only go on forever. And of course, the Greek mythologists had a field day with the legends of Icarus and hubris and the frailty of human narcissism. You know, so this is not new. It's different. It's, I think you've got a global spec bubble this time, which is a variation on a theme. And you've got extraordinarily corrupt local politicians who never think twice about selling off the crown jewels of the British economy, whether it's the education system, the transportation system, the health system, or any of these public utilities that were built up through blood, sweat, and tears over decades. Those are now being sold off to pay down debts that are being foisted on them from foreign bankers, and until the party stops, and then they're going to have to figure out what they want to do. But it'll be like the end of World War II. I mean, the blitz has come, the blitz of money has come, and now it's gone. What do we do?
Well, that's it for this episode of The Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM, the best radio station in the world.
Yeah, bye, y'all.